Well, we thank the organizers for the invitation to speak here. Glad I have students and an advisor in the audience. Let me start with, I've got a couple of groups, G and H, and it's certainly enough for me to think about this case, that they're connected and reductive over C. And I want to have I want to talk about two questions and two not actual answers, but answer schemes of what I would like an answer to be. So first is going to be the most representation theoretic one, which is what's the multiplicity of some irreducible representation V mu, and I'll put the H there to say that it's an irrep of H, and mu is a dominant weight for H, in the irrep VG lambda. And we know how to compute this. This has a very straightforward answer. You can start with, and this is a finite dimensional. So I'm thinking about just very, very classical representation theory. And we know how to answer this. We can start with with the representation here and decompose it under G's maximal torus using the constant multiplicity formula. From there, figure out how H's maximal torus acts on it. And from there, figure out the H multiplicities. But I want a manifestly positive formula. And so already the constant multiplicity formula is not manifestly positive. It's this alternating sum over the Weyl group. Now we know how ways to fix that, such as the Lakshmi-Bhaisa-Chaudhry-Littleman multiplicity formula. But the final step of taking the T multiplicities for H's maximal torus and going back to H, that step has some differencing involved and is again not positive. So that's the first question. And the second question is going to be, what's the non-abelian Dousterman-Heckman measure on the torus for H, the dual of that, and the positive Weyl chamber induced by, so let me start with lambda, and I'm going to hit that with the maximal compact subgroup of G. That includes into little g dual, which I'm going to project to little h dual, and then I'm going to divide by big H to get to, and again, H compact, really, to get to H's positive Weyl chamber. So here I have this nice manifold, and it includes in here as a coadjoint orbit, and in here it's some union of coadjoint orbits, but I'm thinking of this not as just a set, but a set with a measure, and then I get a measure on the positive Weyl chamber. And so here there was a question for each mu, and mu was a dominant weight. Let me leave very specific, a dominant integral weight in TH dual. So dominant gets me a plus. And here I'm thinking more about real points instead of integer points. In this same cone. And the point is that the relation between these two, and I'm not going to talk about this, is Q2 is an asymptotic version Q1. So if we have reasonable ways to answer Q1, we should be able to take limits of them and answer Q2. And if we have reasonable ways to answer Q2, then maybe we can soup them up to and make them more detailed to get answers to Q1. So this I consider the more interesting question, and this one the easier one. And so I would like to talk about that, but instead I'll talk about this. So why would I? So a nice answer would be for this one would be that we would define a polytope P linearly in terms of lambda, and this P is going to be inside R large. Some big. It's going to be a some convex polytope inside there, and a linear map phi from that guy to the positive vial chamber of H, such that the multiplicity of VH mu is equal to the number of points in P lambda intersected with Z to the large, I meant it this way. It's, I take the preimage of mu, intersect it with Z to the large, and compute the number of points in there. Okay? So, I've got a polytope, and I'm counting the lattice points in that polytope. And it's one polytope determined by lambda. And it's, but it should be sort of linearly determined by lambda. So there should be just one polytope scheme for this pair G and H. No, it's not varying. I just didn't want to waste a letter on it, so I'll waste the word large on it. Okay. And the asymptotic version of this, instead of counting lattice points in a polytope, you just compute the volume of the polytope. So answer two would be that this measure, so I'm going to name this measure now, it's the Dousterman-Heckman measure for this original flag manifold and lambda, and it's the Dousterman-Heckman measure for H, that this should be, I push forward along this guy phi, of Lebesgue measure on P lambda. And so if one has a magic polytope that does this, then it'll do that. So that's, again, you should just see this as an asymptotic shadow of the thing you really want. So an example where everything works out beautifully is G is GLN, and so lambda is, I'm going to index it by a decreasing sequence of integers, and H is the torus, and so mu is just any sequence of integers, not necessarily decreasing, and then P lambda is the Gelfand-Setlin polytope . So it's ways of filling in this triangle with numbers so that there's lambda 1, lambda 2 at the bottom, and the numbers are decreasing as you go northeast or southeast. So this is so here large is n choose 2 is the number of lattice points number of points in this triangle. I don't want to confuse these lattice points with those lattice points. The number of points in this of entries in this triangle where you can fill in a number. We get the Gelfand-Setlin polytope with solutions to this. Ways of filling this triangle, satisfying those inequalities. Any particular number here is certainly between lambda 1 and between lambda n. So it's going to be some compact polytope. And the map phi is take differences of row sums. So I have these n rows, and I and maybe the empty row up here with no entries, so n plus one rows, and I take those differences and I get n numbers, and that's my linear map from this polytope to Rn, and I can count, and this guy will solve both problems. It'll, if you count the number of integer solutions to this, it will compute the weight multiplicity. So this is the prototype where everything works out as wonderfully as possible. And let me just give one particular example, so a sub-example, n equals 3. And what the weight multiplicities, so what the multiplicity function looks something like this. So this is a natural valued function on the weight lattice of H, which is, H is abelian now, so the weight lattice is the positive Weyl chamber. Everything's positive. So here I have this function that's zero away from this hexagon and takes these values on the hexagon. And I want to get those numbers by writing down a clever polytope, the Skelton-Shetland polytope. And the polytope looks like this. It's got a triangle in front. It's got a trapezoid in back. Those are parallel. Okay, so they're like this. They're both parallel to the board. And then it's got this funny vertex here. Looks like that. So this is the Gelfand-Shetland polytope. And if you think about taking this guy and projecting it into the board, then the fibers are all intervals, but they increase linearly until you get to the central triangle, and then they're constant, just like these numbers are constant for this triangle in the middle. All right, so let me do, any questions right now? Yeah, well, so everybody disagrees as to how to transliterate Shetland. And so I think, you know, okay, good. So so there I'm not transliterating, I'm just literating. So let me give you an example where this framework will not work and you need to do better. So non-example, you might say, harder example, is I want my big group is going to be SL3 and my little group is going to be SO3. And so I'll tell you a solution to this. So this guy, I've got this representation VAB. And those are in the naturals now. So I'm thinking about SL3, not GL3 for this example. And I want to decompose under SO3, so its representations are indexed by the naturals. So here's what P lambda is going to be, PAB. It's going to be a parallelogram. And on that parallelogram, the parallelogram is of height A, and is this part of it is width B. So that means it goes from 0 to A to, so, and this slope is 1 and that slope is 1. So it goes from 0 to A to B to A plus B. So that's the total width of this is A plus B. Okay? But first, remove the vertices on the top edge with 2 not dividing the x-coordinate. So I keep this one, lose that one, keep this one, lose that one, keep this one, lose that one. It might not have been this one, depending on the parity of A. But I'm not going to count all lattice points in this. I've lost the half the lattice points just on the top edge. And then two, remove all vertices with two not dividing the y-coordinate. So I knock out half of the rows also. And half the time, I even lose this row. So you don't notice the weird thing that I did on the top. Even if this, if A is odd, then you don't notice this. And if A is even, then you do notice this. Okay? And here's phi. Phi now goes to this thing here, which is the positive ideal chamber for SO3. Okay? Now, if I had not knocked out those rows, then the number of lattice points above would go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But because I've knocked out every row, they go 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3. And once we get into the middle, into the between A and B in that range, I guess I have A is less than equal B in this picture. Once we get into that middle range, then we might go 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, or we might go 5, 4, 5, 4, 5, 4, 5, 4. It depends on the parity of A. And then it starts decreasing, 3, 3, 2, 2, 1, 1 at the other end. So this says that this is not going to be good enough if I want to solve the general problem. So it says A1 version 2 allow the lattice to coarsen on lower dimensional faces. Okay, so I'm not just going to have a polytope and a lattice. I will have a polytope, and each face will have its own lattice. And as you go to subfaces, you'll get coarser lattices. Okay. All right, so largely because I don't want to talk about that additional issue, largely because I don't understand fully that additional issue, I am going to no longer worry about the exact stuff, and I'm going to go to the asymptotics. So to not deal with that, I'll restrict it to asymptotics. Okay? And I have to admit that even on the asymptotic side, I'm going to need to generalize that I don't just want to have a single polytope. So I want to allow a polytopal complex. So for the asymptotics, you could just say, I want to add up a bunch of polytopes. But eventually, I am thinking about the actual representation theory answer. So in order to not overcount the boundaries of those polytopes, sometimes I'm going to need those polytopes to be glued together along their boundaries. It's not going to be very relevant today when I'm only thinking about the asymptotics. But the right thought is not that I have a big disjoint union of polytopes. And the right thought is that I have a glued together union of polytopes. All right, so I haven't presented an example where that's necessary or even desirable, but let me say that the Littleman path model for computing branching from H cross H to H is exactly of this form, that you can recast counting Littleman paths in terms of counting lattice points and polytopes, and it's a big union of polytopes. All right, so now let me tell you, I'm not going to think about general G and H anymore. I'm going to think specifically about let theta be an involution of G, and H, which I'm actually going to call K more traditionally, be its fixed point subgroup, or maybe the connected components. So you shouldn't think like a group in its maximal torus. You should think maybe G is K cross K, and theta switches the two factors. And then K is sitting diagonally inside K cross K. Or you could think about the SL3 inside containing SO3 example. And the example I'm really going to care about is when G is GL2N and K is SPN, the symplectic group. Okay. So what else am I going to need? I want a Borel and T that should both be theta fixed. So those always exist. These are inside G. You can always find those. And okay. All right, so first step. So what I'm trying to compute now is this thing, this asymptotic version of the multiplicity function. So instead of this hexagon full of ones, twos, and threes, you should imagine that I have a piecewise linear function that that's constant in the middle and just increases linearly as you come inside, or you know, that the Lebesgue measure times that function. Question? So that's the sort of thing I'm going to compute. All right, so let me let kappa bar, later there's going to be a kappa, but right now there's only a kappa bar. Let me let kappa bar be a dominant weight for G such that, one, kappa bar is not zero, okay, and two, if you take sections over G mod B, let me say it this way first, there should, if I take the IREP of G with dominant weight kappa bar, and I take the K invariance, that should not be zero. So what's true is it's therefore one-dimensional. So this is a nice property of K, called a symmetric subgroup. That if you have one of these symmetric subgroups and you take the invariance inside a G IREP, it's either zero or one dimensional. And frequently it is one dimensional. So there do exist kappa bars like this. I do not mean that they are pointwise. I mean that stable is a good word to use. Yeah. Okay. All right. So what am I going to do with this kappa bar? Okay, let F be in this space of in this in this invariant space, and I want to think about it as I'm taking sections over G mod B of this line bundle for kappa bar, or maybe minus kappa bar, whatever. And I'm taking an invariant section, and of course I want this to not be zero. So if you think about it this way, then you can say F is a section of this line bundle, and it vanishes somewhere. Where it vanishes is K invariant. And another wonderful thing about K being a symmetric subgroup is there are only finitely many K orbits on G mod B.
It's really the classical notion of symmetric subgroup, then it's strict. Not strict.
But I don't. I B and T are the ones that should be theta stable. K is a fixed set. I see. Well, I wrote K equals G theta, and I did not use any other word there.
Correct. So.
Yes. Well, but there I do not have the word fixed or stable, so. That's right. I only used it here when referencing B and T. There we go. We've now replaced the word fixed and stable, and there was never fixed used up there. Okay. So, I've got to, so I have this function, or rather this section of this line bundle, and it vanishes on, it doesn't vanish generically, or it doesn't vanish everywhere, rather it only vanishes on some of the k-invariant divisors. So the cycle f equals 0 is some sum over these k-invariant divisors V of their classes times some multiplicities n super V. And this is going to generalize pretty soon, too. And these guys are natural numbers. They say the order of vanishing of this section on that divisor. All right, now lemma. If you take the Dousermann-Heckmann measure, which is some measure, you know, some asymptotic version of this, you take that on G mod B for the line bundle lambda you're interested in, and you say, let's change it by some amount, some multiple of kappa bar. And so now I've got a family of measures, and I want to take the derivative of that with respect to n. Then that is sum over mv of the Dousermann-Heckmann measure, now not for g mod b itself, but for these v's. And if I had enough technology to write down theorems about Dousermann-Heckmann measures, you'd see that this is a one-line derivation. Really, you can compute the Dousermann-Heckmann measure by integrating e to the equivariant symplectic form, and then Fourier transforming, and then differentiating the direction of the positive roots. And you do a bunch of linear stuff, but it's all eventually about the exponential of this. And so when you take the derivative, you get a factor of k-bar coming, kappa bar coming down, and it leads you to this. So let me just claim that with the right technology, such a statement is very easy. But what that gets you is that let me say lambda is regular, because otherwise the Dousermann-Heckmann measure will be 0. And n is the maximum value of n such that when I subtract off that much kappa bar, I'm still in the positive Weyl chamber. Okay, so kappa bar was some dominant weight. So if you subtract it for a while, eventually you leave the positive Weyl chamber. And I want n to be the time that that happens. Okay? And so I want to compute this thing for lambda, and I know its derivative. So I use the fundamental theorem of calculus to say that the thing I want is this initial value plus an integral, and the integral is going to be of this thing, so let me pull the sum out already. Sum over v, integral from little n equals 0 up to big N of the Dousermann-Heckmann measure of v lambda minus little n kappa bar. Okay. And what I want to emphasize in this statement is the thing I'm trying to compute is written positively in terms of other things. these measures for the, so these are dominant weights, both these guys, because I said let's stay in, let's do inside the positive vial chamber. So that leads to their Dausmann-Heck measures being positive measures, and I'm, and these numbers here are natural numbers. So I'm getting this positive recursion. But it means that I need two new things that I haven't thought about yet. One is I need to extend the problem to not just be about the, let me say it in representation theoretic terms instead of these terms, just for variety. Instead of thinking just about irreps of G, which is to say sections of a line bundle over G mod B, I need to think about sections of this line bundle over arbitrary K orbits. So right here it was for a divisor, but I want to run this again and again and again. So I'm going to need, for every K orbit, I'm going to need to be able to compute this if I want to be able to do induction. And the other thing I'm going to need is to understand what happens as I hit walls. So it's because I have two terms here, this term and that term, that I'm eventually going to need, and actually this may be many terms because there may be many different Vs. For those two reasons, that's why I needed to generalize my framework. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm going to hit the wall, and now this guy is not regular. Right. Big N was exactly defined so that this would stop being regular. So here's going to be another problem, and I should write it down. There's going to be another problem, which is my kappa bar was dominant, and I said, okay, so lambda is regular, and now lambda minus thing is not regular. So if I want to be able to further expand this term, to further expand these terms, I need to deal with other Vs. But to further expand this term, I now need to get myself another kappa bar that stays in that wall. And this I don't know how to do in general. So I will be stating a experimental theorem that comes later that says what computer experiment says that I can come up with those kappa bars, that I need them. But I'll be more precise about that when it comes. All right. Okay. So to go further, we need a kappa bar VI for each K orbit closure V and each, so let me say we usually need, and I, because I want to give you an example where we don't, that'll be easier to picture. So we usually need these guys for each V and for each subset, for each wall I of TG dual. An example where we don't I'm almost ready for that example. So lemma, if kappa V is dominant, then I didn't say what that guy should do. Of course, zero will do, such that two things. One, if we take the line bundle associated to that weight and we restrict it to V, it should not be trivial. Because eventually, what do I do with that line bundle? I take a section of it, and I want that section to vanish some places so that I can do induction. Or another way to say it is I want this big N to actually exist. I want to eventually be able to fall out and have something change. So I want this to not be trivial. And the other thing I want is I want there to be a section over V of this line bundle. That's k-invariant. So I need to cook up kappas that'll do that. Or kappa bars. I haven't had the kappas yet. Now I will. So, lemma. If kappa bar is defined, kappa bar of V is defined to be 1 minus theta V applied to kappa V, where theta V is V involution associated to V. So I'm not going to spell, I'm going to spell this out. Let me just say that in the theory of K orbits acting on G mod B, associated to any K orbit on G mod B, there is a corresponding involution. There's two things you can define. One is a certain twisted involution that lives in G's Weyl group. And that's not the one I want. I want that thing times theta. And that's my guy theta V. So which is theta times the twisted involution. And I'll say exactly what these look like in the SL2 and SPN example later. Let me just say that this is a standard thing one deals with when thinking about K orbits on G mod B. Then two holds. Sorry, and this guy was regular. Let me just say dominance. This guy was dominance. Okay. So if you start with a dominant weight and you do this thing to it, you'll get another weight. That weight may well not be dominant. If it's not dominant, there will be no sections over G mod B. But there will still be sections over V. That's all I need. And that section over V is what I'm going to use to run this this trick again. Okay. So let me draw an example. So I'm going to have G is SO5 and K is SO4. And G's positive Weyl chamber looks like this. So here's some point in it. And K's positive Weyl chamber looks like that. And so here's a T. So positive Weyl chambers. And in this case, if you think about SO5 mod B and think about the K orbits on it, you get a post set that looks like this. There's the open orbit, there's a divisor, and there's two closed orbits. Okay? So let me tell you, for each one of those and this line bundle, let me tell you what the Dassmann-Heckmann measure looks like. So, and then I'll start checking out this integral stuff. So the Dassmann-Heckmann measure for the open orbit, or its closure, really, the G mod B, and this line bundle, so I call this lambda. Now lambda, it looks, and this is the K Dassmann-Heckmann measure, it looks like this. And in here, it's Lebesgue measure. So this is just a fact. I'm not deriving it from anything right now. I'm just telling you in advance. You get, here's lambda in the corner. and you take and you get this rectangle sort of subtended by lambda. Mm-hmm. All right, the Dauss-Kmet-Heckman measure for the divisor, and sorry, I shouldn't use this L, I didn't use it here, and this dominant weight lambda is just this interval at the top. So this is codimension 1 in that, and this, thankfully, is codimension 1 in that. And the Dauss-Kmet-Heckman measure for the closed orbits well, one of them gets me just that point, and the other one gets me just that point. Okay. So you know that if you take this closed orbit, now we're just taking sections of a line bundle over K mod its Borel, and that's going to be an irrep for K, so that's why you should just get a dot in one place. That's right, but so that it's not going to quite generalize like that, but it is that simple in this case. So let me tell you what the kappa bars are for this guy and this guy, and I don't need them for the closed orbits. Here, kappa bar is going to be this vector, and here, kappa bar is going to be that vector. Okay? Any question? Yeah, and likewise on the interval. Lebesgue measure on there too. Dirac delta. Yeah. So Lebesgue measure on the point. Yeah. I mean, it'll be for this talk. It's much more pleasant to make that assumption. All right. So what is this equation saying in that case? Already just for G mod B. It says that if I want to get that rectangle, there's only one divisor, and there's some multiplicity on it, and I'm going to integrate over positions of that divisor. So it says that this Lebesgue measure is really the integral of, so here's that rectangle, it's really the integral of these, where that top edge is moving down. Why is it moving down? Because I'm subtracting off kappa bar. So I move down until it hits the wall. In this case, this term dies. And that always happens from G mod B, actually. It dies whenever in this first step, this term will, in fact, always die. It's the when I iterate, I'll need to keep those terms. So I get to say that this rectangle is really a bunch of these intervals added up together. And then those intervals themselves, that's running this again, those are integrating so here's lambda, and I subtract off this kappa bar until lambda leaves SO5's positive ideal chamber, not SO4's. SO5's positive ideal chamber is here. So this guy runs into the middle. So on this side, I get these points, and on this side, I get these points. Okay. And if you put that all together, then really and unwrap these integrals into saying then really the polyhedral version of this is my answer is equal to this rectangle plus that rectangle. Okay? That this point sweeps out this interval, and then that interval sweeps out that half of the rectangle. All right. So I want to show you what this calculation looks like for GL6 to SP3, and that's gonna, and then I'll be done. And I'm going to need two boards for it, one above the other. So let's start here. So example, GL6 containing SP3. And so here, the k-orbits correspond to fixed point free involutions. I'm telling you for GL2N in containing SPN, more generally. How about I call them iota sub V? So V is the orbit closure, and iota sub V is its corresponding fixed point free involution. And this guy, theta V, is minus iota V in this case. And when, so I need to tell you more about the posets. So here, I said I've got my function on my orbit V, and it vanishes on some guys V prime that are smaller than it, and so I need to tell you what the divisors are in a given orbit, what the possible V primes are. So when V covers V prime in this poset of orbits, they differ in four places. So let me show you what the 2n equals 6 case looks like. The biggest orbit looks like that, and the next orbit looks like that, and the closed orbit looks like that. Okay. So these are pictures of fixed point free involutions. 1 is paired with 2, 3 is paired with 4, versus 1 is paired with 3, and 2 is paired with 4. Okay, so this is the poset of orbits of GL of SP2 acting on GL4 mod B. Yes, I wanted to draw a smaller example. Eventually, I'm going to get there. So this is GL4. I wanted to emphasize this thing. The different four places. So there are two arches involved in any covering relation. Only two. And the two arches might go from being separated to start crossing, or go from being crossing to being nested. That's what happens in a covering relation. And then, MVV prime, so I haven't defined this guy yet. This is the order of vanishing. Remember before I had those MVs. This is the order of vanishing of the function inside kappa bar. I have my dominant weight kappa. My dominant weight kappa gets me a weight kappa bar for which there is a non-vanishing section. And then I want to know where does that section actually vanish, a non-zero section. I want to know where does that section actually vanish. It vanishes on some V primes. And that are covered like this, and it vanishes to some orders. And I'm telling you now what those orders are. This is equal to the left value of kappa plus its partner minus the right value plus its partner. So what does that mean? So here, maybe I have A, B, C, D is kappa. And then if kappa is this, then going from here to here, the order of vanishing is A plus B minus C plus D. So A plus what it's matched with minus D plus what it's matched with. Whereas from here to here, it's A plus C minus B plus D. So my line bundle has gotten me, I'm replacing my line bundle with a union of these divisors V prime, and now you know the coefficients that I'm going to use on those. All right. So let's do the calculation. I'm going to start with the open orbit. And I want to, what I want is to write down a bunch of kappas that do have these two properties. So each orbit I'm going to meet along the way, I'll write down a kappa that meet that has those two properties. And if I'm already stuck in a wall, then I want kappa bar to be in that wall also. So let me say that. At each vi, we need a kappa dominant such that kappa bar defined there, which is that 1 minus theta v, so I'll put v's on these things, kappa is in the I wall. And this guy is, this line bundle is not trivial, on V is not trivial. Okay. So let's get started. Here's my, my open orbit, my G mod B, and I'm going to take my original kappa to be omega 1. So the first fundamental weight of GL6. And that means that omega 1 bar is 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. So this 1 minus theta v is 1 plus iota v. So you take this guy and you hit it with 6.3 involution and add those together. And that's why I get a 1 over here also. Right? So when you wander out, so this is my kappa bar. When you start here and you wander out in the, there's two things I need to compute, right? I need to compute these multiplicities, and see which V prime arise with non-zero multiplicity and what the multiplicity arise with, and I need to figure out what wall I might wander out. So to compute the multiplicities, I have this formula. I think about all the covering relations of this, and there's two. I could make these guys cross like this, and then I would get 1 plus 0 minus 0 minus 0, or I could make these guys cross, and I would get 0 plus 0 minus 0 plus 0. So I only get actually one covering relation like that, which is this one. And that's one of these terms that shows up as I'm integrating. Okay? And the other thing that could happen is that is this. I could wander out through a wall. So I'm starting with my dominant weight lambda, and I'm subtracting some multiple of this. Now, for lambda to be dominant, it has to be weakly decreasing. You subtract off a multiple of this, and here's the danger. At some point, lambda 2 is going to equal lambda 3 when you subtract off this. That's lambda 1 and lambda 2 will decrease the same amount, and these guys will all stay the same, and we'll hit the wall where lambda 2 equals lambda 3. So one might expect that there would be a term like this where now these guys are required to be equal, and that's the notation I'm going to use. But actually, this term dies. This the Dassmann-Hecker measure associated with that term is 0. And why? It's because it's because the once you hit that wall, the line bundle one's dealing with, or the symplectic form one's dealing with, is pulled back not from G mod B, but from the corresponding G mod P. And that symplectic form, that pre-symplectic form, is degenerate and gets you zero volume and zero Dassmann-Hecker measure. So really from here to here, I have this omega 1, and this first formula says to calculate that, There's only one term here. It looks like there might have been two terms, but only one of them has a non-zero multiplicity on it, and this term dies. And I said I wanted that here, but I'll just continue from here. So maybe I won't finish this calculation, but just to see a little bit more. So here, let's take omega 1, and then this covers a few things, but the only time you get a non-zero multiplicity is when it covers this guy. And again, the boundary term, as we hit the wall, vanishes. But then this one, there's actually two terms. So again, so here, I'm going to use omega 1 and omega 1 bar. No, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. Huh? All right. So again, here I've got omega 1 and omega 1 bar is just omega 1 plus iota applied to omega 1. And this covers one thing, which is this guy, that and that can interact. And there is, I'll put an integral on it, so there's one of those terms. And there is now a possibility that we hit the lambda 1 equals lambda 2 wall. As we're subtracting this off, we might hit the lambda 1 equals lambda 2 wall. And so we might hit that wall, which means we need to consider this boundary case. Same V, but now we're insisting that we're on a certain wall. So here would be a case, just to be clear, here would be a case if I used omega 1, then it would not work. Omega 1 would get me 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Omega 1 bar would get me a 1 here and a 1 there, and omega 1 bar would not have these two being equal. So for each one of these orbits, I need to be able to find a weight, maybe a fundamental weight or something, that satisfies these conditions. And I could finish this one up and say, yes, actually here, they do all, I can find these omegas, and so I can get a polyhedral answer for branching from GL6 to SP3, and actually invoke some stuff that says that it works non-asymptotically, it works on the nose, which has to do with there being a unique conjugacy class of cartons in theta stable cartons in for this particular symmetric pair. But let me say, I don't know that in general. I only know that I can do this through GL22 contains SP11. So I'm working on the general case.